You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, why volcanoes simmer, erupt, and behave the way they do. Here's what it looks and sounds like if you're in Hawaii County on the Big Island of Hawaii right now.
It smells like burning asphalt and trees, and sounds like an engine going off. You hear popping and rocks, and it looks like it's a mix of liquid red and orange, and like along with the black cinder rock, kind of drags along, leaving behind a white ash.
That's the Kilauea volcano, which has been rumbling and bubbling and erupting for years. But a new fissure has opened, and streams of lava are forcing evacuations and endangering the lives and homes of hundreds of Hawaiians. Today, understanding the science of volcanoes and why it's difficult to predict what they'll do. As you listen in, what are you curious about in the science of volcanoes? And if you've traveled and experienced a volcanic eruption or two, which one made the deepest impression on you? Kathy Werzer and I were talking a minute ago about Kilauea and being there in Volcanoes National Park to see it. My favorite volcano is Arenal in Costa Rica. Maybe you've been to one. Maybe you've witnessed an eruption. Maybe you've actually managed to grab one in a photograph. You can tweet that to me as well. So 651-227-6000 for questions about volcanic science, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, where you can send me your photos of the volcanoes that you've been to and observed. It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Carrie Cooper is with us. She's a volcano scientist at the University of California, Davis, and with us from Davis, California. And Carrie, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Jess Phoenix is with us. She's a geologist and founder of the nonprofit Blueprint Earth. She's also running for Congress because she believes more scientists should serve in Congress, and we'll talk about that, too, a little later. Jess, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Jess, hasn't Kilauea been doing something that many volcanoes don't, which has kind of been in eruption mode continually for 30-something years? What's been going on with it?
Well, that's right. Kilauea has been erupting pretty much continuously since 1983. That's a little unusual when compared to what people typically think of with volcanic activity. Most people believe that volcanoes are shaped like cones. They're very steep, and that they erupt explosively all the time with a big boom. Kilauea is a different sort of volcano. It's what we call a shield volcano. So the lavas that it produces are a lot more fluid, and they ooze more than explode most of the time. And they don't have those big cataclysmic eruptions that you would see from something like Mount St. Helens. Most of the time, they erupt sort of like what we're seeing now.
So, Carrie, that Mount St. Helens, which is something I think many people remember or have seen photographs or video of, that was one of these blowout eruptions. Does that mean that there was buildup within the volcano, but there were no signs that it was actually going to blow? What happened with that?
In terms of Mount St. Helens, there actually were quite a lot of signs that something was happening for several months prior to the 1980 eruption. And that's kind of typical for a lot of these volcanoes, although one of the interesting things is that each volcano does behave a little differently. So I think that one of the things that we're trying to do as a science is get better at reading these precursor signs. Volcanoes are one of the few natural disasters that give us this kind of early warning, if only we can figure out how to decipher it.
What were the early warnings at Mount St. Helens?
So at Mount St. Helens, for several months, there was increased earthquake activity, and the volcano itself, so this is one of these cone-shaped volcanoes that Jess was talking about, the side of the volcano began to bulge, just like sort of blowing up a balloon in terms of being pressurized by the magma that was being forced inside of it. And so all of those things were signs that something was happening, and the U.S. Geological Survey was watching it very closely. It was just a question of when it would erupt and how it would erupt.
Jess, I was reading that there were also what they call a swarm of earthquakes leading up to what happened with Kilauea over the last week or so. What would that be a sign of is going on inside the volcano?
Well, when you see earthquake swarms like that, there's a few different kinds of earthquakes that exist. One that people think of when they think of things like the San Andreas Fault is a very different thing than what you see on Kilauea or other volcanoes. These are called something, they're called volcano tectonic earthquakes.
Okay.
So they're actually an interaction between the volcano and the surrounding rock, basically. So when magma is moving through rock underground, it breaks surrounding rock, and it can build pressure up, and then when that pressure is released, you see that in earthquakes. So that's a particularly large 6.9 quake, which was the largest since the 70s there in Hawaii, was pressure in the surrounding rock had built up, and there was movement underground. So that is a result of magma traveling around underground and forcing its way through cooler rock that is not magma.
Carrie, I think you said in some ways volcanoes have their own distinct personalities. Does that mean that the lava that they're spewing out can also be different depending on which volcano that we're talking about, the quality or characteristics of the lava?
Yes, that is certainly true, and that's one of the main reasons why some volcanoes erupt or tend to erupt explosively, and some volcanoes tend to erupt in lava flows like Hawaii. There are some broad classes of lava, ranging from the sort of very thick, sticky lava that we call rhyolite, that would be for something like Yellowstone volcano or the Taupo volcanic zone in New Zealand, and those tend to be the most explosive. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have the volcanoes like Hawaii, which have the thinner, runnier, more fluid lava that then is less likely to explode.
We have a question from Will, who called in from St. Paul, who says, would I sink or float on lava? Terry, what do you think?
You would float, because lava is definitely more dense than you are, although I wouldn't recommend jumping into liquid lava, because you'd probably then burn before you either sank or floated.
I'd not recommended from a hazards perspective.
Yeah, Jess, you really can't get that close. I experienced this at Volcanoes National Park. You can't get that close to flowing lava because of the danger of the gases. Is that right?
Well, it's a couple of things. When you have flowing lava, scientists actually, with Hawaiian eruptions in particular, are able to walk right up to them and sample the flowing lava. That's something I've done. And it's very, very hot. So you have a few hazards there. So you've got the gases. If there is a lot of gas activity, those gases are very harmful to humans. Sulfur dioxide is one of the main components, and that's not something you want to breathe in, because in addition to smelling like rotten eggs, it is very bad for your lungs.
Okay.
Also, the heat, lava flows, when they're moving across the surface, can top 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's not something you want to be too close to. And then, of course, if you're out on an area where there are active lava flows, you may see the flows on the surface, mm-hmm. but you may be unaware of lava flowing beneath the surface. So what you're walking on that may seem like it's decent solid ground may actually have a hollow lava tube underneath of it with a river of molten lava beneath. So you might fall into that. So we don't advise that the general public ever goes close to flowing lava, because it really is dangerous, and there are often more dangers than are just visible to the naked eye.
How hot is it? I mean, you said that the lava is extremely hot. What's the temperature range?
2,000 degrees Fahrenheit is not abnormal for a surface.
Wow.
Lava.
My gosh.
So five or four times the hottest temperature on your oven, basically.
Can I ask, Carrie, why it's so hot?
Well, you have to... lava or magma is molten rocks. So you have to get rocks hot enough to melt in order to actually make the magma itself. And so they're coming from deep within the earth, where things do get that hot. And so it's just a reflection of them coming up to the surface fast enough that they haven't cooled off.
Listener on Twitter says, walked on some newly cooled but still warm Kilauea lava fields some years ago. Peak experience. Now, Jess, given what you've just said, that is not without its risks. If you're walking out in an area that you can still feel the heat of the lava, is that right? Or the cooled lava?
Yes, the Hawaii Volcanoes National Park staff has restricted those areas where we have active flows. You're not supposed to go on them, but of course, security has been tightened in recent years. A couple decades ago, it was much easier to get close to active lava flows. And even now, it's not like they have the park fenced off because it's so massive. And
right.
A lot of people live in areas where there could be erupting lava, as we're seeing right now. So, I mean, it's just something that we say, please don't do, because we don't want anyone getting hurt.
Jess Phoenix is with us. She's a geologist and a volcano expert. Carrie Cooper is with us. She's a volcanologist at UC Davis. And we're talking to them, of course, because of what's going on at Kilauea. If you caught the beginning of the show, we mentioned that Kilauea has been bubbling and simmering and in some kind of erupting mode since, what did you say, Carrie, 1983? But what's going on there now is, we thought, worth a conversation about the science of volcanoes. What makes certain volcanoes behave the way they do? What are some of the things that you're curious about when it comes to the science of volcanoes? And if you've traveled and experienced a volcanic eruption or two, or you've been out hiking around a volcano, which one made the deepest impression on you? I'm going to ask our guests about Arenal in Costa Rica, because sometimes that's my favorite volcano. Sometimes that erupts and then it goes very quiet for some time. And they love it when it erupts because, of course, it brings in the tourists to see it. But if you have a favorite volcano or you have a question about volcano science, this is a good chance to ask it. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. And on Twitter at CarrieNPR. Jared says that he's been to Arenal and it's gorgeous. He also says Nicaragua has some fantastic volcano hiking as well. Carrie, what is it about certain parts of the Pacific Rim, Latin America, that these volcanoes are still sometimes active and other parts of the world where they're not and they've been dormant for a long, long time?
So long, long time really depends on your perspective. And so from volcano perspective, we consider volcanoes potentially active if they've erupted sometime in the last 10,000 years.
Okay.
And that's even a little bit arbitrary. Something that is even older than that could still potentially erupt. So I think that part of what's happening is that volcanoes tend to operate on timescales of decades to centuries. So if you just happen to catch one when it's in a dormant phase, that doesn't mean that it won't erupt 10 years from now, 5 years from now, 100 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
And so different volcanoes do have sort of different recurrence intervals, so to speak, but they're not regular. And so it just really depends on what's going on below the surface.
Got it. You know, Jess, I was also curious if a volcano's past is sometimes its prologue. You know what I mean? Like, what their past behavior, what does that tell us about the future behavior?
Well, that's actually one of the biggest areas of research in volcanology, which is, you know, what we try to do is understand the potential that different volcanoes have to erupt. I mean, if you think about it this way, we know that Yellowstone, for example, is what's known as a supervolcano. It has erupted at a truly cataclysmic level, and, you know, ash that we have found from previous eruptions stretches east as far as Washington, D.C. So that ash, you know, we didn't observe it falling. It's something that we found and preserved in the rock record. And because of that, we can use techniques to date, basically when that event happened. So that's how we know that Yellowstone has erupted 640,000 years ago, 1.2 million years ago, and 1.8 million years ago, approximately.
Wow.
So we can put past together by documenting physical evidence that we find. And the same is true for volcanoes that erupt very frequently, like Mauna Loa on Hawaii and Kilauea on Hawaii. Those are volcanoes that, you know, they're active within modern times. So we do have historical accounts that we can say, oh, yes, this lava flow reached this town in, you know, 1851 or whatever the year is. And then we can use our dating techniques, the chemical dating techniques that we have, or, you know, any type of dating techniques, cosmogenic nuclides, which are a whole different thing. We can use that to help us refine our techniques and then test them against observations of flows or deposits that may predate when humans were around.
Oh, my gosh.
So there's a lot of ways we can reconstruct it. Yeah.
Wow. Call here from Zeke in Ely, Minnesota. Hi, Zeke.
Hi, good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And I've always been fascinated by volcanoes from the time I was a little kid.
Uh-huh.
And I've been to Iron Mall, and it's wonderful because it creates huge bangs and roars when it does.
Right.
But my favorite volcano was Popocatépetl in Mexico, one of the great ones.
And tell me why. Have you seen it erupting?
Oh, it's sporadically in eruption now, but I actually climbed it back in the early 1990s, and it had a glacier on top.
What?
And it has,
are you sure
yes.
you didn't dream that, Zeke? That sounds like
no,
it's too good
no,
to be true.
No, this is true. And on top of that, they had little huts as you could stay in that had been built out. They were about the size of a bookshelf, of course, and the nights were bitter cold. But when you get to the top of the mountain, you look down into this crater that's about 2,000 feet deep, and in the bottom is this little tiny turquoise lake, steam coming around.
Wow.
And as the ice melts on there, rocks are cut loose. And I ended up spending the night on the volcano, and probably the only level spot around. And I was terrified of boulders that would be coming down the mountain. You could hear them.
Oh, my gosh. So Zeke, thanks so much for the call. Jess, are you familiar with this volcano with the glacier on top? Can that be true?
Oh, yeah. And actually, Mount Rainier in the United States has more glaciers on a single peak, I think, in North America than any peak up there.
Wow.
I think it's got 25 plus. And, you know, Carrie may know the exact number, but it's about 10% of the whole park's surface is covered by glaciers.
Yeah.
So Popocatépetl, yeah, I mean, it's extremely possible. And it is a fact that you can have a glacier on top of a volcano. And that actually creates another type of hazard from a volcano,
which is
so it's called a lahar,
uh-huh.
which is a it's basically a superheated mud flow, and they are caused when the volcano erupts and the glacier is melted by that heat, so it starts to rush down the slopes of the volcano and it mixes with mud and sediment, and those mud flows can be extremely deadly. In fact, we saw them kill, I think it was either 24 or 26,000 people in Colombia from a volcano there in the 80s, which was Nevado del Ruiz is the name of that volcano.
Wow.
So it buried an entire town.
Carrie, glaciers on Rainier?
Yeah.
More details on that?
Well, so I don't actually know the particular number, but it's not at all unusual to have glaciers on volcanoes because they tend to be, especially these so-called stratovolcanoes, the ones that form the cone-shaped mountains, they mm-hmm. tend to be high places, and they tend to get a lot of snow. So a lot of the cascades in the North Pacific Northwest, so Mount Hood, Mount Rainier, Mount St. Helens had glaciers on it, and in fact still does. And so a lot of these do. And as Jess says, the lahars are one of the main kind of hazards to human life, along with hot ash flows, which are another type of hazard.
Cynthia called to ask, when volcanoes erupt, do they erupt in constant flow like a faucet, or do they pulsate?
Mm-hmm. Most of them pulsate.
And why? Do we know?
Well, so it has to do with the physics of why they're erupting. And ultimately, one of the things that's causing volcanic eruptions, especially causing explosive eruptions, is that the magmas have gases dissolved inside of them. And so when they come up to the surface, then those gases come out of solution, they exsolve, and they form bubbles, and those bubbles expand, and then that expansion then essentially blows the magma apart from the inside out. And so it's kind of like a combination of shaking up a soda bottle and then having it be thick enough that it'll form popcorn. And when you do that, then it is that process is not entirely smooth. And so you have these pulses in some volcanoes, and you have other volcanoes that are more smooth, like Kilauea. But even Kilauea has pulses. You know, you have over the course of just the last few days, you've had fissures opening, and you've had eruptions, and you've had brief pauses, and you've had new fissures opening. So it tends to be more episodic.
Yeah, I'm coming back to the fissures here because I think the science of that is interesting, and vents opening because
mm-hmm.
we're hearing that. But to back to the calls here to James in Alexandria. Hi, James. Sounds like you lived in Hawaii for a while. Is that right?
Yeah, Carrie. We were newly married, and we moved to Hawaii. We lived there for 4 years, and I had a very, very pregnant wife. She was about 8.5 months, and we decided to take a trip to the Big Island,
uh-huh.
and Kilauea was erupting. We rented a camper. We were with Mom and Dad, too, and toured the island, but when we got out to where the lava was flowing across the road, the rangers were very, very casual. They let us walk right up to it, and then it would move slowly,
wow.
And then they'd take the barricades and move them back a little bit. And we probably stood there for 3 or 4 hours while we watched the volcano slowly come down the road, and it was probably one of the most magnificent sights I've ever seen in my life.
So this is an interesting description, James. Let me take this back to Jess. Jess, in a situation like that, would there not be a lot of danger to the people that are standing, you know, near this lava flow, or have they just gotten a lot stricter about what they'll let you see and get close to?
Well, there are certain areas that the scientists at the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory, I did a volunteer researcher internship program there back in 2008. And, you know, there are areas where the scientists will go out, they will map the flows, you know, they'll update that map frequently, and they'll determine what the hazards are. Once they've assessed what the hazards are to the general public, you know, there is a very strong public interest in having people see that stuff up close and in person, because you're literally seeing new Earth being created. And it's something that it's really wonderful when we can share that with the public and let people see it. So oftentimes what they'll do is, if they've determined that an area is safe to view the lava flows from, they will set where the perimeter is, and you can approach up to the perimeter.
Okay.
And then the National Park staff will be supervising and letting you know when you have to move back. So it sounds like that's what happened. And you could still do that on there were different flows, the Kalapana, Waikupanaha. There's areas of the previous eruption stage that were where you could walk up. And I took my parents several years ago so they could see it. But don't ever do it unless you are there with the park staff and they can tell you where the safe areas to view the lava are.
Call here from Aaron in Harmony, Minnesota. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Your parents are living near Kilauea?
Well, they're right now in Minnesota here, but we do have a house on Makamai Street, which is in Leilani. The hardest part for us is just watching our neighborhood kind of burn. Our neighbors have been, some of them have lost everything, and it's just really hard to watch here.
Oh, wow. Do you know what state your parents' home is in?
So far, it's still standing. The only thing that we can really do is look at aerial views of helicopters and such, and just trying to look at houses. Our house is actually pretty easy to spot because it has an orange roof. But what we've been doing is trying to contact our friends who also live on the streets and tell them, because they don't know what's going on, since they're a little bit they don't have access to the internet like we do. So we've been giving them a call and saying, hey, we saw your house in this aerial view at this time, and it's still there. So some people have been able to get back in, and I don't think that's possible anymore with the recent fissures closing off the southeast quadrant of Leilani. But it's been really hard, just kind of watching our neighborhood go down.
Aaron, I'm wondering if and I know, you know, when you decide to buy or build a house, just as like on the coastal United States, you factor in the risk of hurricanes. I mean, what do the community leaders say, or what did they say about the risk of this happening in that neighborhood?
People who live there, they know that it's lava zone one. That's why land can be relatively cheap. But the thing is, the last time that area was covered in lava was hundreds of years ago, and people every day anywhere have a much higher risk of getting hurt in a car accident or any other type of accident compared to having a house burned down in Leilani, even on Kilauea. The odds of that happening are much smaller.
Well, I hope your parents' house survives, and I appreciate the perspective on this. Carrie, what do you think about this idea that, and I hear Aaron on this, you know, you have a better chance of being hurt in a car accident, but sometimes this happens. How do you factor in that risk?
It's a tricky thing, right, because you know, you think about the risks. You have a better chance of doing a lot of things than getting hurt in a car accident, and yet some people do. When a car accident happens, that doesn't mean that it's not devastating to the people who are involved or the people who are around. So I think it's one of these things where, as you said, if you sort of look at it just purely from the risk perspective in terms of percentages, it makes a lot of sense. But it's one of those things where you just have to, I guess, kind of cross your fingers and hope. And it's one of these things also that I think forecasting is is moving forward. We're not right now. Forecasting is sort of historically based and based on the geologic record and kind of pattern recognition for a given volcano. But the thing that one of the things that's exciting about volcano science right now is that we are really moving towards a state where we could actually realistically do some probabilistic forecasts like we do for weather. We're not there yet, but it's one of these things where there was a National Academies report that was just came out about a year ago, about a year ago now. And one of the main conclusions from that was that it is possible that we could move towards that kind of a probabilistic framework within the next decade or so.
So
it would take a lot of resources.
So just to that, I mean, when the swarm of earthquakes started rumbling, evacuations began. Are we talking forecasting that would go, you know, much earlier than that? Or is that kind of what this would look like? In a week, we may get an eruption. Get out of your house.
Yeah, knowing when it actually would occur would be amazing, and being able to pinpoint it and saying, oh, you know what, at 12 p.m. tomorrow, we're going to have an eruption. But, you know, we are still a ways from getting that specific with any sort of prediction or forecast. And, you know, it really is something that would be great to have, because then we could warn communities in a lot more effective of a way. Because right now, oftentimes people will be evacuated in an overabundance of caution, mm-hmm. particularly around those more explosive volcanoes, the stratovolcanoes like St. Helens, Rainier, Pinatubo, you know, that we've heard about. So those are, we really would love to be able to not move 20,000 plus people if we don't have to. But it's something that, you know, we are still, you know, we're still in the early stages. I try to tell people all the time that volcanology is a relatively young science, because we just sort of moved into the modern realm of it with the eruption of St. Helens in 1980.
Really?
So we're still learning a lot all the time.
I didn't realize that. Carrie, we've been using the word explosive, and I was reading about the explosivity index yesterday. Is that a scale that scientists like you and Jess actually use, and where would Kilauea fit on that scale if it is?
We do actually use it. It's not an exact measurement, so it's more of kind of a semi-quantitative measurement, but we definitely do use it to sort of compare, broadly speaking, different eruptions. Kilauea would be down at the sort of explosivity of 0 to 1 index, and then whereas something like the massive Yellowstone eruption that Jess was talking about earlier, the one that covered most of the U.S. in ash, that would be an explosivity index of 8.
Oh.
So there's everything in between.
Wow.
Mount St. Helens was, I believe, a 4, something like that. So Mount St. Helens 1980 was actually, in the grand scheme of things, a sort of small to moderate eruption in terms of explosivity.
And Kilauea, again, you said you would put at an 8?
Kilauea is down at a 0.
Oh, at a 0.
Yeah.
Oh, so wow,
it has to do
really?
With, it has to do with the amount of material that it produces when it erupts.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how high it sends it into the atmosphere.
Okay.
Right.
So because Kilauea is not very explosive, then it scores low on that explosivity.
Got it. Okay. So this is really the force with which material comes out of the volcano.
Yeah, pretty
much.
And you combine that with how much material it ejects.
Okay. Here's Alex on Twitter who says, in Guatemala, I didn't know this, you can hike up volcano Pacaya and roast marshmallows on the lava. Wow, I need to do that. Amazing experience that would never be allowed outside Latin America. And to Lucy in Rosemont, Lucy, it sounds like you've had an experience with a volcano in Quito. Is that right?
Yeah, I was actually on the plane ready to take off when the pilot says the Pichincha had erupted,
mm-hmm.
so they canceled the flight. And I got to my tiny hotel, and the TVs were talking about don't get out of your house. If you do, take a towel with wet water. And so I got outside, and just one day, the city of Quito was completely covered with this ash.
Wow. I've been there. That's a big city. How long ago was this?
That's what I was thinking right now. I don't know if it was in the late 80s.
Okay.
But then I thought, if I stay in this town, I'm never going to get out. So I decided to there was a bus running to Guayaquil.
So
I did that. I took the bus to Guayaquil. And then when I ended up in Bolivia, I kept reading that the airport was closed. They closed that airport for at least 2 weeks.
That, I mean, that's also what happened with the volcano in Iceland, too.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, and that brings up a really good point about volcanoes in the sense that, you know, if you're in the path of a hurricane, you kind of know that you're in the path of a hurricane. It has limited reach.
Right.
But volcanoes, especially the explosive ones, they can have effects that are extremely far-reaching. And not just direct effects, but indirect effects. So, like, for example, the Eyjafjallajökull eruption in 2010 in Iceland, that caused billions of dollars of economic damage from a relatively small eruption because it sent an ash plume over Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And because volcanic ash isn't like ash from burning a tree or something like that. It's actually tiny particles of volcanic rock, and they're very abrasive. And they just really get into electronics and anything you can imagine where getting some grit in the system would be a problem, like an airplane engine, for example.
Yeah.
And so there has been a policy where airplanes just don't fly through ash clouds. And we don't know actually how much ash can be tolerated by airplane engines. And so the conservative approach is just don't fly at all. And even a few millimeters of ash that is on an airport can keep airplanes from flying, because then when they take off and land, they stir up that ash and it'll get into the engines. And so aviation hazards are another huge category.
Will you say the name of that Icelandic volcano again?
Eyjafjallajökull.
Nicely done. Carrie Cooper with us from UC Davis, and Jess Phoenix with us, co-founder of Blueprint Earth, a nonprofit, and a geologist. We talk about science a lot on the show and the importance of communication, and you two are excellent communicators. But a lot of scientists they still feel reserved about talking about their research or doing this kind of media. Carrie, tell me how you think about this, the importance of communicating.
I think it's critically important to communicate, and I think that probably a lot of scientists actually want to communicate more. It's just that it's not a skill set that science really selects for, typically.
Well, what do you mean by that, selects for?
Well, the things that get you far in science are abilities, like the ability to go into the lab and persevere and, spend long hours working away. And there are relatively few requirements in terms of success to be able to communicate to the general public. It's certainly critical to be able to communicate to other scientists. But being able to talk to people and to take the science that you're thinking about at a very detailed level and bring that back out to the big picture is something that takes thought and practice.
Jess, I know you've been thinking about this a lot because you're running for Congress, because you believe that more scientists ought to be in Congress. I do, too. What are you saying about that as you talk to potential voters?
Well, it's really just a different way of looking at policymaking. It's a very scientific approach. Science is political in that when a government decides what it wants to fund science-wise, it's making a statement that is political. But the scientific method is not. The way that we analyze data and look at the facts and evidence to come to, to make our analysis or come to a conclusion to eliminate an uncertainty, that is actually an objective process. To the extent that humans can ever be objective, that's what we try to do. Mm. And so, when I talk to people, I really stress the importance of having a scientific trained person, or hopefully many people, in government, because it just adds a different way of looking at problems that it comes from our years of training.
Agreed. But also, I mean, so many of the policies that Congress and state legislators and mayors and our elected leaders are dealing with have some kind of dimension of science to them. And it can be pretty sophisticated. I think we want our leaders to be able to understand some of the basic science that informs these decisions that they're making. How confident are you, Jess, that, you know, that that's well understood?
You know, I think that people are having kind of an awakening to that need these days. Because, I mean, we are ever more dependent on technology. And, of course, technology comes from science and scientific research. Whether it's the phones we're talking on right now to the people listening online and live streaming, this is only possible because of scientific research and technological innovation. So when we have even our cars having computers in them, I think it's pretty clear that we need people who understand issues like cybersecurity and climate change and basic principles of science in office and helping to make decisions. And at the very least, elected officials who don't have that information or that training need to have the ability to get information from the experts and really listen to what the experts are saying.
Yeah, I appreciate you too weighing in on that. To the phones now, back to our volcanic science show here to Chris in Apple Valley. Hey, Chris, thanks for waiting.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, yeah, Well, my favorite volcano is Haleakala in Hawaii. And actually, I've heard that the plates shift so that the first volcanoes were on the Garden Island on Kauai, and then the plates would shift. Mm-hmm. So Haleakala is a national park, and I think it's dormant or inactive. You can hike through it, and it's just amazing. I did that, and it was definitely an unusual peak experience.
I'll bet. So you're asking us about the shifting plates and where the volcanoes. Carrie, what about that?
So Hawaii is an example of what we call a hotspot volcano, and you can think about this as moving sort of a rubber sheet over a blowtorch kind of thing. So if the blowtorch stays in the same place, the sheet is the plate that's moving over it, and you're going to be heating up different parts of that plate. And if you just keep moving it in the same direction, you're going to end up heating up a sort of a line, a linear chain. And that's what we get with Hawaii. We get a linear chain of volcanoes. Now, as we were talking about earlier, it's not entirely smooth, so you don't get this ridge. Instead, you get one volcano, and then a little farther on, you get another volcano as the sort of episodic processes take hold.
Lindsay asks a good question here, Jess, on Twitter. Why don't all eruptions end up with results like Pompeii? Jess, have you been to Pompeii? It's an extraordinary place to visit.
No, and you know what's really funny is that as an undergraduate, I actually studied ancient Greece and Rome. That was my focus. And then I ended up going into volcanology, and I still haven't been there. But I have studied it, of course, in an academic way, not in a researching sort of way. But the reason that doesn't happen is that we had a very specific set of circumstances. The eruption of Vesuvius in AD 79, which is the one that everyone knows, it had two phases. So the first phase, there was a very large ash cloud that came up from the volcano. It actually, it buried Pompeii in about 9 feet of volcanic ash. So again, as Carrie mentioned, that's volcanic rock. It's not just ash like from your fireplace. But then behind that, there was what we call a pyroclastic surge. So pyroclastic flows are clouds of rock and gas that move at pretty high rates of speed, and they can come through an area and really just bury everything in its path. So there are actually two pyroclastic surges in Pompeii, and those two things combined, because of Carrie does a lot of work with volcanic chemistry, but the chemistry of that eruption meant that the eruption itself would be a lot more explosive than effusive is the term we use for the more oozy, flowy Hawaiian-style eruptions.
Uh-huh.
So it was really just a perfect set of really bad circumstances for the people in Pompeii and Herculaneum.
So, Carrie, that is why when you go to Pompeii, you will see people and life basically froze where it was.
Right.
Because of the gas that followed?
Yeah, well, it was this hot gas and hot ash flow, so a pyroclastic flow, pyroclastic surge. And these things are really devastating. They move at over 100 miles an hour. They can reach temperatures of 700 degrees Celsius.
Wow.
And one interesting thing that I read about Pompeii in particular is that they have looked at the remains of the people within these cavities, and so there are some bones that are preserved.
Yeah.
And by looking at essentially the burning patterns on them, their interpretation is that a lot of what killed those people was simply the heat from that. It wasn't that they suffocated. It's that they essentially just got flash heated to the point where they just died.
And there, and it appears that there was no time to get away because, you know, you can see dishes on tables and that kind of thing. People were not aware of what was happening.
Though, is that if you look at the volcanic deposits, at the very base of the deposits, before you see the deposits from this ash flow, there are a bunch of rocks and rubble. So it seems like there was a lot of earthquake activity. And so if people had known to interpret that earthquake activity as a possible precursor of an eruption, then they could potentially have gone away. So we don't know exactly how much the shaking happened or how early the shaking happened, although I think records are that it was at least weeks to maybe months prior to the eruption. So if they had been able to interpret that activity, then they could potentially have left and evacuated.
Call you
and
from...
Of course,
go ahead, Jess.
Just real quick, I was just going to say that, the of course, at the time, the belief was that, you know, the volcano god Hephaestus, or Vulcan, was the one who was responsible for all of the earthquakes. They did not know it was, you know, a physical process
of
underground.
Course.
They thought it was a god. So, you know, they're just going to try to appease the god. They don't. They didn't try to leave.
Right. Call from Gina in Vadnais Heights. Hi, Gina.
Hi. I'm not sure I can articulate this question well. We were just in Costa Rica at Arno and took a walking tour with a guide.
Yeah.
And we had been in Hawaii in 2008 and took a trip to the Big Island. And there was no lava flowing while we were there. So we've not seen lava, hot lava. But we walked on the lava fields, and they were very different. And I asked the guide in Costa Rica, and he said they were two different types of volcanoes. I'm looking as I'm waiting, and I guess that's a large question. There must be several different types of volcanoes.
It's a good one, though, Gina, because, I mean, we heard about a shield volcano, which is Kilauea, but, Carrie, I don't think we talked about the two different kinds. Do you want to pick that up?
Yeah. I mean, it depends on, you can actually divide it into many different kinds, but broadly speaking, we tend to talk about explosive volcanoes and, as Jess said, effusive volcanoes, so ones that tend to produce lava flows. And a given volcano can go back and forth between one type of activity and another activity, but ultimately what controls the sort of typical behavior of a volcano has a lot to do with the composition of the magma that's erupting, the lava that's erupting. So if you get thicker, stickier lava, then that tends to erupt more explosively. And if you have more fluid, runnier lava, that tends to erupt more in lava flows, more gently.
Jess, I keep coming back to the fissures because we're hearing a lot about this, and I don't think I've asked you for an actual explanation. Is there a difference between a fissure and a vent? And what does it mean when we hear that Kilauea is opening new fissures?
Well, actually, they've been referred to as fissure vents.
Okay.
So really, you know, a vent is where you have the inside of the volcano coming out to the outside world, essentially. And fissures are basically cracks is one way to look at it. And so these fissures are opening and they are allowing volcanic gases and lava to come out to the surface. And it's probably a good time to point out that it's magma when it's underground. And it's lava when it's on the surface.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's a basic one.
That's good to know.
Yeah. But these fissures, they're opening in an area that is known as the East Rift Zone of Kilauea Volcano. And a rift zone, as it sounds like, rift means pull apart, of course. And so this is an area where the ground can pull apart and you can see, venting of gases and you can see eruption of lavas. So these fissures, I mean, I think they're up to 13 and 14 now were the most recent ones. So it's definitely something that, we can see more of them appearing. And they're a result of, the pressure underground being such that the heated materials want to escape from the surface.
So, Carrie, when we hear that it's opening fissures in places that it never has before, what else does that tell you about Kilauea and what's happening inside? Anything?
Well, it tells you that, first of all, I would say it's probably not that it has never opened fissures there before. It's just that we haven't seen it historically. And so what it's telling you is that there's magma moving below the surface and pressurizing. And one way to think about this is that the rocks above it are solid and they're going to break. It's kind of like if you've got a bread crust, the bread crust will have these sort of cracks that form on the surface as the bread inside expands.
Mm-hmm.
And so the same kind of thing, broadly speaking, happens. So if you're expanding, you're pushing more magma into that area of the rift zone, then the rocks above it will expand and crack, and then that'll allow it to get to the surface as lava.
Call here from Tom in Rochester. Hey, Tom. Thanks for waiting.
Thanks for taking my call. I got one question and maybe a quick follow-up.
Okay.
One of the main questions is that if a volcano erupts, does it take away pressure from all the other volcanoes within the area or maybe even potentially on the planet? And number two, is there such a concept that has been maybe in the works right now or will be in the works sometime in the future of control volcanoes?
Control volcanoes. Okay, so Carrie, pressure from one volcano being taken away from another.
Yeah, no, that's a really good question, and it actually is something that is the focus of some studies. And there have definitely been some cases where there seem to be paired eruptions, where one eruption will at least be followed closely in time by another eruption at a nearby volcano. Now, it's not a very simple correlation, and there's a lot of complexities, and one volcano erupting won't necessarily set off the volcano next to it. So there are probably some broad connections, but they probably have more to do with the overall forces that are acting on that particular region of the crust.
Okay.
And in terms of control volcanoes, I guess it sort of depends on what you mean by control volcano. There are certainly some volcanoes that we know a lot about, like, for example, Kilauea and Mount St. Helens, because they've been the subject of a lot of study, a lot of focused study. There are a lot of volcanoes in the world that we know very little about. There's somewhere between 1,400 and 1,500 active or potentially active volcanoes in the world.
Wow.
About 500 of those have erupted historically. And so even in the United States, you're probably surprised to know that there's 169 potentially active volcanoes in the United States.
Really?
And its territories.
In places we wouldn't expect, or?
Well, I mean, there are, for example, between 8 and 10 volcanoes in California that a lot of people don't know about.
Yeah.
And what's really kind of unnerving is that fewer than half of those in the United States have even one seismometer to detect earthquakes, and less than 2% have continuous volcanic gas measurements. And those are two of the primary ways that we see these precursor signs of eruptions.
Carrie, what's your holy grail volcano to see?
The one that I would like to see most?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's an interesting question. I've actually been to a lot of them that were sort of on my bucket list, so to speak. So I've been to New Zealand, I've been to Iceland. I would really like to see one of the Alaskan volcanoes sort of off in the northern part of Alaska, I think.
Great to have you on the show. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Jess, your holy grail volcano, what is it?
Well, I recently was able to visit one of them, which was Old Bunyolingai, which is a volcano in Tanzania. And it is the only volcano on Earth which produces white/gray lava flows. So pretty unusual. They're a type of lava called natrocarbonatite. It's the only place on Earth where we actually see that lava produced. So I got to see that in person. So I have to move my holy grail volcano off Earth and say Olympus Mons on Mars, which is the largest volcano in the solar system. It's the size of the state of Missouri. So I would love to see that one.
Jess, thanks for taking time away from the campaign to talk to us about volcanoes.
Course.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Here's Jimmy Buffett with What Else Volcano.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.